Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here, and welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. And today we broadcast from the Fox Cities Book Festival on the UW Fox Valley campus in a wonderful facility. And hey, listen, we have a huge crowd. Oh, thanks everybody for coming. It's a really great crowd, and I know they're going to be participating as we go along today and visit with our guest. And our guest is Jerry Apps. And Jerry and I have done more than one show together.
Yes, we have.
We've done a lot of shows together. He's a storyteller. He's an author of many books. He's written Campfires and Loon Calls, Horse-Drawn Days, Cranberry Red. His most recent is a collaboration with his son Steve and wife Ruth, and it's the book is called Garden Wisdom, Lessons Learned from 60 Years of Gardening. And I've read the book, and I love it, and I know you're going to love it, too. And it's going to be a lot of fun talking with him today about his experiences as gardeners. I hope you'll call in with your experiences as well. Some of the good things that happen, some of the bad things. We'll try to answer some of the not too technical questions.
Yeah, the sort of technical ones.
The sort of technical questions we can deal with. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. You can they email us? I guess they can email us at talk@wpr.org. We can take that as well. And as always, you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll figure out a way to get that question or comment on as well. If you got a great garden photo, I hope you'll send that along and put it up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, because we'd love to have that as well. And from the audience, I'm going to have our audience members. The place is full. It's really great to see so many people here. If you have a question or a comment or an experience to share about your gardening or your gardening traditions, I hope you'll join in as well. Cynthia Schuster, who is handling our on-air production today, in-house production, I guess we could say there. She's waving her hand. And as you're listening on the air, I hope you can see her as well. Know that she's there and she's waving her hand. Anyway, we're really happy to be here. And glad to talk about Jerry's book. And gardening has always been a part of your family, hasn't it?
Pretty much so. I'm a farm kid from a couple of counties to the west of here, Washera County. And during the latter years of the Depression and World War II, when I was growing up, we always had a garden, huge garden, and depended on the garden for much of our food. My mother was in charge of the garden. I have two brothers, and she made sure that my dad and my two brothers and I had an opportunity to participate in the garden. We are of German background. There's no one here in the audience, of course, with that background. And my mother, she was true to the stereotypic German. When she was in charge, look out, she was in charge. So gardening was her thing.
And you grew food not only for the family, but you sold some of the extras?
Well, sure. On our sandy western Washera County farm, which was just west of Wild Rose, we had at different times as much as an acre of cucumbers. Anybody here in the audience pick cucumbers? Oh, look at the hands. And they all loved it. I can see from the smiles on their faces. And we had generally an acre of green beans. We had as much as an acre of strawberries. That in addition to all of the regular vegetables.
And a lot of potatoes.
Oh, we had 20 acres of potatoes. Now,
planted. How'd you like the whole 20 acres of potatoes?
Yeah, really. Yeah, especially in the hollows where the quack grass grew. But we planted the potatoes by hand. We dug them by hand with a six-tine fork. And the country school that I attended, we had 2 weeks of potato vacation. It's true. So all the kids in the country school for 2 weeks picked potatoes.
And did you have off for deer hunting, too?
No, we did not have off. In fact, there weren't any deer. It really, it's true, in those days.
Oh, man. Jerry Apps, our guest today, as we talk with him about his book, Garden Wisdom, Lessons Learned from 60 Years of Gardening. And your father gardened in his 80s.
In his 90s. The last picture that we have of my dad, he was 93 years old. And he was standing. Right. He's standing in his garden. It's on the cover of one of my books, Rural Wit and Wisdom. And
it's in this book though too, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. I think it's in here. Anyway, at age 93, he was still gardening. And 6 weeks after my son Steve is a professional photographer and did all the pictures for this garden book, by the way. But 6 weeks after that picture was taken, my father died. And I asked the doctor what was the cause of his death, and he said there wasn't any cause. He just wore out. And isn't that a wonderful way to go? Spending his time in his garden up to the end.
Absolutely. Well, obviously, it didn't hurt his health gardening.
No, he was. I could tell when his health was beginning to diminish. Because at our garden, and we garden at my farm, which I still have west of Wild Rose, I could tell each year his little part of the garden got a little bit smaller every year. And I never said anything about him. I said, Pa, how many rows you want this year? And he said, well, 10 probably enough. And the next year, how many rows, Pa? Maybe 8 this year.
Yeah.
Which is kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we have callers online, but before we go to the phones, I love the way you've organized your book here, because you take us kind of through the gardening season, and we meet the vegetables and fruits as they ripen.
That's correct. And I need to do this quickly because my wife is in the back. My wife is responsible for all of the recipes in this book. So all of the...
There's a lot of them.
There are 50-some recipes. So not only do we go through the year talking about the different vegetables and fruits that come ready, but then we have Ruth's recipes of what to do with all this stuff.
And she tried and true on every one of them.
Well, several times. And in fact, one of Ruth's favorites, and she'll run for the door when I say this, we have a recipe in this book. Hold your breath now. You want to listen carefully. Rutabaga pudding. Doesn't this grab your attention? Just to say it is fun. Rutabaga pudding.
Jerry Heff's our guest. Call. You can join in, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. And Joe in Lake County, Illinois, has a question for us. Joe, are you there?
Yes, good morning. Good afternoon.
Hi.
Hi. I feel I'm too anxious. I tilled my little garden, and I feel that it may have been too wet, and I'm making clots, maybe marble-sized. I'm wondering what I can do to break up those clots.
Well, one way to do it is you take two blocks of wood... No, I'm kidding. That's a real problem, especially if you have soil with a considerable amount of clay in it. You want to you really want to avoid working that soil too early. My farm is very sandy, and as soon as the frost is out of the ground, we can work it. What to do with it is there's not a whole lot you can do with it. As you go through the season. In my experience, the little clots and clumps will begin to disappear. Occasionally, people will end up with clumps as big as a brick, and then you really got a problem.
Yeah, and I think I would do nothing now. Do nothing.
Exactly.
Let it dry out.
Yeah, it'll pretty much take care of itself, I think, as you go through the season.
It reminded me of a story that you tell in your book, things you were just making here, comments you just made here about potato beetles and some of your work getting rid of insects and neighbors. And
yes,
stuff.
I have a getting rid of neighbors. No, we don't.
No, neighbors getting your neighbors getting rid of insects.
Oh, sorry. I have a whole chapter in the book on critters. But a quick story about a critter problem. One of the problems that we have is potato bugs, and that's a perennial problem for those who garden and grow potatoes. And my dad was one to always answer an ad in a magazine about something that was exotic, something just a little bit different. And he saw this ad, a sure cure for potato bugs. And he sent in his 50 cents to wherever, and back came this little package. And he opened the package, and here were the directions, two blocks of wood and the directions. It said, place the potato bug on block A, strike smartly with block B. And by golly, it works.
Oh, I laughed when I saw that. I saw that story in your book. That's one of the funny stories. Oh, man. Cal and Sugar Camp up next. Let's go there. Hi, Cal.
Hi. I was just wondering, how did you store potatoes and carrots and onions for the winter? If you don't have a cold spring house, how do you keep them cool and not too moist, not too dry?
What we do in our we live part of the time at our farm and part of the time in Madison. And when we made a small addition to our Madison home, I did build onto the room in the basement a cold room, meaning that the temperature really never got much above 50. And it really works because we're still eating potatoes that we grew last year that we have in this little cold place. Carrots are a little less. They don't last quite as long, to put it more politely. They're not going to last as long as the potatoes. But that's what we've done. We keep the squash and the pumpkins and onions, all that sort of thing, in this little cold room that's in our cellar. Now, people do all kinds of things. If your garage is one that doesn't freeze hard, and you want to freeze the stuff, that's a place where you can do it. You have to keep the vegetables cool. That's the answer to it, I think.
Yeah, well, a lot of people keep them in coolers.
Exactly.
In garages. I know somebody else who actually dug a hole.
Yeah.
Dug a hole outside, and he's got essentially a cooler, insulated area that he dug in the ground, and then he covers it with hay and straw, and then he can go out there in the winter.
That's a good idea.
Pick it out.
Part of the challenge with potatoes, especially, is to grow a variety that stores well. Some do not; they just don't store well. So when you look in the seed catalog, be sure to look at if you're interested in having them last throughout much of the winter, to look for a variety that stores well.
And speaking of varieties, you have a list in the book somewhere of all of the varieties that are most of the varieties that you grow every
exactly
year, and of every vegetable.
Yes, and we. We grow both heirloom varieties, the old-time varieties that have withstood the test of time. And I like my father, who is always trying something different. I'm always trying new varieties as well. Some work and some don't. I'm not a purist in the sense that we only grow heirloom varieties. We grow hybrid sweet corn and that sort of thing. So we have many varieties. Another thing I did in the book, which is kind of interesting, and I'm not sure we want to get into it very much, but for each of the so-called standard vegetables, I dug out the history of that vegetable, where it first originated, where potatoes came from, and where beets originated, and so on. And I'm mostly a historian, a rural historian, so it's always kind of fun to find out something you don't know that relates to the history of something.
And we'll find out about the history of peas coming up next year in just a minute. Jerry Apps, our guest today, author, with us on this edition of Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Author Jerry Apps, our guest on this edition of Garden Talk, his latest book, Garden Wisdom, Lessons Learned from 60 Years of Gardening. He's got photos by his son Steve, who is a national, international reputation for his photography. He's won kind of like the top awards that can be won. And recipes by Ruth, his wife, Jerry's wife, who is a wonderful cook as well as a long-suffering wife, probably. By the way, you can join in with questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. And those of you in the audience, if you have a question or comment, we would love to hear from you. And Cynthia tells me we have somebody with a question.
My name is Janet Hughes. I live in Grand Chute, which is right outside Appleton. And my question is about burning. Mm-hmm. We have a little wildflower garden. Not little, it's like 20 by 30. And you're supposed to burn it every spring, and it seems like I never get the right weather. So is it too late to do it this year?
This year is a very difficult year in much of Wisconsin because right now it is so very dry that last I heard, I think we have a burning ban almost throughout the state. On my farm, I do prairie restoration. I have 10 acres of prairie that I'm trying to restore. And a lot of wildflowers in my prairie, obviously. The advice that I get is that, well, I should be burning my prairie. Well, I brought some people out there from Fish and Wildlife Service who specialize in the burning of things like prairies. I'm also a tree farmer, and I have acres. I have 125 acres altogether, but I have acres of trees that pretty much surround this prairie. And so I don't burn. I mow things down, but I don't burn. Burning is a good thing, but it's so dangerous. There's so many examples of where a good-intentioned burn gets out of hand, and right now it would be illegal to do that. It's supposed to rain this weekend, but we'll see.
Let's hope. Yeah. Let's hope it does rain. And so in the meantime, I'm assuming that you're mowing in those years when...
No, we haven't done that, but maybe we'll try that.
Yeah, mowing is second best. It does not do what burning does, but it's second best.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for that question. And you can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Tell us a little bit more about your farm, Rochera Farm. And you have a great book about your farm, too.
Yeah, it's called Old Farm. I think they have multiple copies in the back of the table. No, our farm is... just west of Wild Rose. It's 2 miles from where I grew up. And that's where we have our garden. That's where I have, now about 75 acres of trees. A couple of years ago, we planted 7,500 red pine. People say to me, what's an old guy like you planting trees? Why are you doing that? Well, we've had this farm since 1966. I've planted trees every year since then, at least a few. And, well, tree planting is the hope of the future. It's something that I believe in very strongly. When you plant a tree, I'm not doing it for me anymore, but I'm doing it for my grandkids and maybe their kids. And it's such fun to watch all that stuff grow and change. The trees we planted a couple of years ago now are nearly shoulder high already. My gosh, unbelievable. Yeah.
And the farm itself has been a work in progress for a long time.
Well, since 1966. It was a poor old farm. I dug out the history of it. It was settled in 1867 by a Civil War veteran who got it as part of the Homestead Act and grew wheat. Can you imagine that? Much of Wisconsin was wheat in the early days. And it's stony, and it's hilly, and it's right on the terminal moraine, which makes it very interesting, if you know anything about geology. It's where the glacier stopped. And just to the west of us is the old glacial Lake Wisconsin, which has become now the vegetable center of the Middle West in many ways, that vegetable-growing area south of Stevens Point, Plover, and mm-hmm. toward Rapid, Wisconsin Rapids, and that way. Number one now in green beans, snap beans. We're number three in potatoes. Lots of sweet corn comes out of there. So vegetables are a very important part of Wisconsin's history. Aside from those of us who grow gardens for our own use, our vegetable growing history and canning history goes way back to the 1800s, starting in Manitowoc County, as a matter of fact, where the first cannery was organized. But that's a whole other story and a book I'm working on right now.
Well, we'll talk about that when that book comes out then. Cynthia has another
Hi, my name is Bonnie. I'm from Appleton. I've had a garden for about the last 5 years, and in this area we have a lot of clay. And I've noticed that every succession of years, my tomato plants do less and less and less. Now, I've been trying to move it around, but I mound. I just don't know where else to go, although we did. My neighbors just cut down a huge mulberry tree, which used to give a little bit of shade. Now I'm going to be in full sun. So do you have any suggestions for how to amend? Because I do compost, and I do straw. So I'm just kind of curious what else I can do to get better.
Yeah, there are several things. But first, with tomatoes, full sun is really essential.
Yeah,
and
it's great.
You discovered that. Did you have blight problems with your tomatoes?
No, production dropped. Yeah.
Have you done a soil test on yours?
I have not, no.
Well, I think you might want to try to do that.
Doggone. No.
Because that's I'm an old county agent, which you'll now discover when I start telling you when you get the soil test. But you can have the soil sample take to the county extension office, and they'll send it in for you. Or how many master gardeners are there in the room? There are several. They know this. They know all about this sort of thing. Now you can go. You can any garden supply store. You can buy a little kit. It's about $5. Not very expensive, and that will tell you the amount of nitrogen you have, the phosphorus you have, potassium you have. Tell you the pH of your soil. That's a good place to start. Now let's talk further about how do we loosen up this tight soil, and I don't have that problem because we're sand. I have the opposite problem. But one of the ways that I found useful is each fall I plant my garden to a winter cover. And what does that mean? That means I buy some winter rye or winter wheat, whichever is the less expensive, and I as soon as everything is harvested in the garden, I sow it to that either wheat or rye. And it gets up in the fall, if a decent longer fall, as we often have, it gets up 2-3 inches or more, nice and green, looks great. In the spring, I have a huge garden, so I plow it down, but you can rototiller it down, or you can shovel it in. But that adds organic material, a lot of it, to loosen up your soil. The next thing I do, I do a lot of mulching of my tomatoes and my broccoli and my cabbage and eggplant and all that stuff. And I put straw, which I grow on my own property, and I put that around. And then I work that into the soil. All of that helps to loosen things up. And it's very natural. It's very organic. It works.
Yeah. Yeah. And we have some more callers here. I think Tom and Madison might be next. Let's go to Tom. Hi, Tom.
Hello there. See, I wanted to make a comment. I've been gardening myself for about 20 years, and I've been using a hoe called a stuffle hoe or a stirrup hoe, and I'm shocked when I talk to other gardeners how few people know anything about this hoe. And as with me, I hate weeding, but this stuffle hoe cuts the weeding time down to about a quarter of the time, and that's why I'm just shocked that more people aren't using it. And I think if more people were using it, people would enjoy gardening more, and we might get more people to garden because of cutting the weeding time down. I was wondering if this gentleman could make some comments about the stuffle hoe to get our listeners to get out and buy one and make their gardening experience more fun.
Describe it for us, please. Describe it for us, please, so we all know exactly what it is.
That's all.
Are you still there, Tom?
I'm still here, yes.
Oh, yeah. Can you describe it, the hole?
Well, the stirrup hole is the shape of a stirrup on a horse's saddle. It has a carbide blade that you push back and forth. You set it on the soil, and you scuff it back and forth, and it cuts the weeds off either at the surface, or if you put a little downward pressure on it, it'll go down an inch or 4 inches. And if you scuff it back and forth to cut the weeds off instead of chopping like you would a regular hoe, the carbide blade stays sharp longer. And even if it gets dull, I've never sharpened mine in 20 years, actually, it still cuts the weeds off rather nicely, but it doesn't disturb all the layers of, the biological activity in the soil because it goes along rather than digging up clods of dirt to get out the weeds, it cuts them off either underground or on the surface. And, ideally it works better when the soil is dry. You don't want to use it when the soil is wet because it does lead to clumping as well. But I was wondering if our gentleman here had heard of the Stirpo or if he uses one himself.
I have. Once you've described it, I know exactly what it is. I do not use one. It sounds like a wonderful thing to use. My advice to people when they ask me about weed removal is, and I have a whole chapter in my book on hoeing.
It's a great chapter.
And it's to the point. As an old farm kid, I had my own pitchfork. I also had my own hoe. Nobody touched my hoe. And my dad had his own hoe. Hoes are sort of personal. You develop an attachment to them, and they work for you. And I suspect I could move into this new technology, but it would be troublesome at my age to shift gears into another kind of hoe because I have this special...
But you're a three-hoe man. You have three hoes.
I do. They have different purposes, but for weed removal, I have hoes for digging and planting, and I have hoes for heavy-duty work, but then the fine work... The intricate work that has to be accomplished close to the plant. I have this wonderful little hole that Larry, I'm talking about this before, which I bought at an auction.
I have one just like it.
I paid $1.25 for it because people didn't know what the heck. The other was worn out. It wasn't worn out. It's a thin little hole. You go to Fleet Farm or wherever you buy your stuff, hardware store, and these massive big old holes, they're clumsy. They're terrible. The first thing I'd do if I had one, saw the thing in half. Too big. Clumsy.
And
by the way, I offer instructions on hoeing.
And sharpening, and you do.
Sharp hoe, very important. Try to keep it away from your feet.
Oh, man. And Cynthia, you have another question here from the audience.
You talked about planting trees, and in my yard, I planted some beautiful purple leaf plum, radiant crabs, and they started to develop, I think it's called black fungus. Are there any, and I know there's nothing I can do about it, that's what I've been told by the Extension Center. Are there any trees, decorative type trees that you can plant that won't get this fungus? I'm going to have to cut down most of my trees because of it.
You know, I'm really not the right person to answer that. My experience with landscape type trees and fruit trees is very minimal. I'm a commercial tree grower. If you ask me about red pine and white pine and black oak and white oak and bur oak and all that and aspen, I could tell you a lot. But I have to tell you a quick story because when I was an extension agent and this woman called the office. I was extension agent in Green Bay. And this was back in the 60s when there weren't any master gardeners. I wish there had been some, because I was not a master gardener. I'm just a gardener. And I was a livestock agent. So here I get a call. This woman's got a beautiful plum tree. Could I come out and look at her plum tree? It is in trouble. It was prize tree. And so I go out there and look at her tree, and she says, what can I spray it with? It's got some terrible difficulty. And I looked her tree over, and I said to her, I would recommend pruning. And she said, what kind of pruning? I said, I would prune it level with the ground. Before I got back to my office, my supervisor had the biggest smile on his face. I just got a phone call from a woman with a plum tree. What did you tell her? So you probably are doing that yourself.
I haven't done it yet. I'm going to wait until it falls down.
No, go for pruning.
I tried pruning, branches,
no,
and it's not going to help. It's my shade in my backyard.
Oh, this woman had the same story.
What tree would be good to plant then as a shade tree that's kind of...
Fast-growing?
Fast-growing. Well, not so much fast-growing, but just so it's pretty.
I like the ornamental maples. I have an autumn blaze, I think it's called, which is a wonderful tree. That does well for me. How many of you have an autumn blaze? Quite a few.
I do, but...
Yeah. But your needs pruning? Did I hear a but?
That was me. I don't like pruning. pruning that one.
Well, you probably wouldn't have to do much pruning with an autumn blaze.
No, no, really.
That's for sure. Thanks for that question or comment. And Rod in Weyerhaeuser, I think, is up next. Hi, Rod.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I was just going to comment before they were talking on the potatoes. The gentleman was saying about keeping. We've always had good luck with Burbank, russet Burbanks and Kennebec for keeping. And then last year I said, oh, what the heck, I'll try this new variety. It's called Blue Chip, or I think it was Blue Chip. Well, they keep good too, and they're like the skin is like Kennebec. They're not quite as knobby. And also, as far as the potato bugs go, my neighbor, he's the one that told me about this Diatomaceous earth, which is, I guess it comes from the coral reefs or something. It's really micro-sized coral, you know, razor sharp, and the darn potato bugs, you know, they eat that, and it cuts their interiors up, you know, and I guess that's all I was going to comment.
Diatomaceous earth is what you're talking about there, yeah.
There are many, many ways of dealing with the potato bugs besides the two-block system. Well, one of the ways, of course, it's foolproof. When the adults first appear in the spring, is to just pick them off one at a time and put them in a little pail, a little water, and then you've done it. One of the things, we used to have city cousins come out all the time, visit us on the farm from Chicago. They didn't know a potato bug from anything. And one of the dirtiest trick in the world, when the little ones are getting about, they'll be around a quarter inch or so, and we had a lot of strawberries, and we said to these kids, now, there's our strawberry patch. Just go down the road, just pick those potato bugs off. They're strawberries. And this little, what a dirty trick. This little 8-year-old cousin, he's going down the road. He couldn't even say strawberries. It's hawberries, and he's putting the potato bugs in his mouth. Terrible. Isn't that terrible?
Terrible.
That's a terrible trick.
That is terrible. You're ruining me.
Oh, yeah. Well.
All right. Well, more tales from Jerry Apps here. Getting his 8-year-old kids to eat insects.
Well, he's a healthy kid. Did well on them.
You know, I said before our break, I said we're going to learn a little of the history of the pea. And I want to get back to that because I sometimes, and rightfully so, get accused of saying I'm going to talk about something and then never getting back to it. So I want to go back to the pea because the pea goes back at least 3,000
years. I've got it right now. And they were grown in the Nile Delta as well as in India and China. And can I read a little bit here about that?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
The Roman upper classes viewed peas as a food for the common people and for soldiers. And dried peas became a staple of ancient Greek and Roman soldiers, as they could be easily carried on long trips and were excellent sources of protein. During the Middle Ages, people dried peas and stored them for times of famine. They sometimes ground the dried peas into flour, which they mixed with wheat or rye for making bread. Dried peas were also soaked overnight and turned into peas porridge, or peas, you're learning something you didn't know, or peas pudding. They could also be ground into pea flour, mixed with water or milk, and baked on a griddle. The Romans introduced peas to much of Europe, but eating fresh peas did not become popular until the 1600s. And I bet you didn't know this, but Thomas Jefferson was enamored with peas. And he had 15 different varieties of peas at Monticello and enjoyed competing with his Virginia neighbors to see who could have the first crop of peas in the spring. More than you ever wanted to know about peas.
So peas, porridge, what's the old
peas
poem?
Porridge hot, peas, porridge cold.
Peas. Cold.
That's it.
Some eat it hot, some eat it cold.
But that's where that comes from.
And I was also peas porridge in the pot 9 days old.
Well, that's sort of like eating the potato bugs.
Oh, man. Jerry Apps, our guest today. Jerry is the author of many books. His latest, Garden Wisdom, Lessons Learned from 60 Years of Gardening. I'm Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. We're broadcasting today from the Fox Cities Book Festival at the UW-Fox Valley campus and the Student Center. It's a wonderful place, a wonderful facility. Great to be here today, and thanks to a wonderful audience. And none of them have snuck out yet on us either. They're all here. They're sticking around as we visit with Jerry Apps about gardening and his book, Garden Wisdom. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Just a quick comment from Phil on our Facebook page, who chimed in and said, I never feel I've tried to grow a plant unless I've killed it at least twice.
I know the feeling.
And we have a question from the audience.
Hi, I'm Denise from Appleton, and I'm wondering if either of you have heard of straw bale gardening and if you have any opinion on that.
I've heard of it, and I really don't know very much about it. Larry maybe knows more than I.
No, I honestly I've heard about it, but I haven't tried it and haven't seen it demonstrated either, so maybe somebody who's listening in could call in with a comment on it, though. I mean, that often happens on this show.
Sure. What's interesting is today there are so many different ways of vegetable gardening, from square foot gardening to raised bed gardening.
Lasagna gardening.
Yeah, there's all many different. I'm an old-time, old-fashioned old farm boy garden. Our rows are 30 inches apart, for heaven's sakes, in my garden. Why so far apart? Because we use a rototiller to go between the rows. And we have, what I just planted last week, 10 rows of potatoes. Well, that's a lot of hoeing if you're going to hoe between the rows. So you rototill.
All right. We have another Doug. And is it Doug in Plymouth up next?
Hi there.
Hi, Doug.
Great show. Say, your guest was talking about planting trees, and I know you have deer in Washera County. I was wondering what he does, if anything, to minimize the damage to the young plantings of the by the deer.
It depends on the variety of trees. I plant mostly red pine, and the deer essentially don't touch my red pine. They would much prefer Fraser fir and some of the Christmas tree varieties. They also will chew my cedar trees right down to the ground. And if it's really a tough winter, they will eat the bottom branches of some of the white pine. But I've not had any deer problem with red pine. Now with my garden, maybe we'll get to this. I've had deer problems that won't quit, and I've spent years figuring out how to deal with deer in my garden. But they essentially don't trouble my trees. I wish I could encourage the tree, the deer, to eat buckthorn, though, because
yeah,
I've got buckthorn. My gosh, I was in my woods yesterday. I've got way too much buckthorn. I'm hoping that a day will come that either some critter will decide that buckthorn is really the thing to eat, or some plum disease will take over the buckthorn.
Actually, goats. Goats will eat it.
Oh man, I'd have to have about 100 goats.
there are actually some people who raise goats and will take them to areas for a fee and turn them loose on the.
We'll talk later. I'll trade rutabagas for goats.
Rutabagas. You got a nice piece about rutabagas. Anybody here from the Cumberland area of Wisconsin? Cumberland has a rutabaga festival every year, and I think they still have a rutabaga queen. I did some of my doctorate, my PhD work in Cumberland. Cumberland and Barron and Neillsville were areas I worked in. And I enjoyed Cumberland, and they really like their rutabaga. They like their rutabaga. And you've got a little piece on rutabaga.
Oh, I tell you, I'm considerably experienced with rutabagas. In fact, I have a children's book. The entire book is called Eat Rutabagas. So I'm so pleased with that vegetable that I'm encouraging everyone who has not tried it to try it. One year, my dad decided, this was in just before the war, this would be World War II, said, this year we need to make some money, and to do that, we are going to grow rutabagas. And now rutabagas, according to my dad, really do best on breaking ground soil. And today there's 1 person in 10 that knows what that means. That means soil that's never before been plowed. And we had about 3 acres on the west end of our woods that was fairly open. And we took out the stumps and we plowed it and we sowed it to rutabagas. Now, this is 3 acres that we sowed to rutabagas. Got a whole big sack of rutabaga seed from the hardware store in Wautoma. Took all the rutabaga seed they had. He said, what are we going to do with my regular customers? My dad said, they can come buy rutabagas from us because we're going to have breaking ground rutabagas, and people are waiting. They are waiting to buy rutabagas that are grown on breaking ground. And so that year it rained regularly, and the rutabagas came up, and they were delightful. They were not in rows. They were just broadcast. Jeez, I'm breaking the place apart. All over the place. And they grew. And in October, we went out to the rutabaga patch with our 6-tine forks, and we dug this whole patch of rutabagas, cut the tops off with a big butcher knife, hauled them to the cellar. And each bushel that we put into the cellar, I put a little rutabaga in a box. And when we were all done, I said to my dad, he asked me, he said, how many bushel do we have? And I said, we have 375 bushel of rutabagas. And I said, at this point, I said, what are we going to do with these rutabagas? And my dad said, people are waiting. There are people out there waiting to buy breaking ground rutabagas. And so how are we going to do this? And he said, we're going to peddle them. How many of you had an opportunity in the audience to peddle something?
Door to door.
Peddling means you go to door to door trying to sell somebody something that they don't want, I discovered later. And so we were in plane. We loaded a bunch of rutabagas in the back of our 1936 Plymouth, took the back seat out, and we went to Plainfield, and we went to the first house. Now, I have twin brothers. Cute little buggers they were in those days. And so I would go up to the door with a rutabaga, and I would say to some whoever came to the door, how many bushels could we sell you? And this woman looked me right in the eye, and my cute little brothers are standing behind me, and she said, oh, geez, what a bunch of cute kids. And she said, I'll take one. And I ran back to the car, and I said, Pa, she wants a bushel. And so we took this big bushel of rutabagas up to the house, and she had this great funny look on her face. Her eyes got really big. She said, where are you going with all those rutabagas? And I said, you said you wanted a bushel. And she said, no, I just wanted one. One rutabaga. I ran back to the car and I said to Pa, she wants just one rutabaga. One rutabaga? Nobody wants one rutabaga. You can't even make soup from one rutabaga. What should I charge her for one rutabaga? 5 cents. Ran up to the door, collected my 5 cents. That's the way the day went. 5 cents here, 10 cents there. One person even brought a quarter's worth. And we came back home with most of the rutabagas. Then the next day, the next Saturday, we went to Wapaka. The next Saturday, Wautoma, and went to Pine River and all the little towns all around. And to quickly end the story, we probably had 250 bushel of rutabagas remaining in our cellar. And come April, my Uncle Wilbur, who was a mill caller, stopped by, and he said, there's something dead in this house. And we thought, now, those were the days when mice and rats and all that kind of thing were fairly common, and my mother was a very careful housekeeper, and she was really concerned that some mouse had died someplace, and we looked everywhere, and we could not find any dead vermin, but we did find a cellar full of dead rutabagas. And we loaded all these rutabagas, carried up. Rutabagas have a goodly supply of sulfur in them. That's why they're really wonderful. They really are. They're very, very healthy. Loaded all these rutabagas into the manure spreader, hauled them back to that same patch, spread them on the ground, and planted the thing to oats, and the oats grew like crazy. And my dad's famous last words, at least the oats like rutabagas.
Oh, that's a great story. Oh, man. Jerry Heff's our guest today. And you may have a question or comment for him. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Question from the or comment from the audience.
I want to talk about rutabagas some more.
Okay.
Please.
My sister lived in Cumberland, so I was very much aware of the Rutabaga Fest, although you could ask your sound man because he sort of acted like he was from Cumberland. Maybe. No. My sister said they don't really grow rutabagas there. They just wanted some sort of festival.
I can understand why.
But my other question about rutabagas is we like them, and we always have them to eat raw, cut into sticks. Yeah. And they seem to be the only thing that comes to the store covered in wax, and I always wonder, do they come so far that they have to be in wax?
They're stored for such a
long
time.
No, the quick answer is that the wax protects, helps, so they store well. Otherwise, they dry up, and they turn into what we had happen in our cellar, unless you do that. Now, many of the rutabagas that you find in the stores in our neck of the woods here in Wisconsin come out of Canada. And sometimes you can't even find them. Here's a little known fact. Rutabagas, when you eat them raw, are very mild and very pleasant to eat. And when I was, I still do occasionally a school talk to fourth graders, and I was talking about rutabagas, this kind of story I shared with you. And Ruth and I would bring along little pieces of rutabaga, and most kids had never tried rutabaga. They never heard of rutabaga. They don't know the difference between rutabaga and a turnip. And so we slice up these little rutabaga pieces, and they loved them. They really did. Here's what happens to rutabaga, though. When you heat them, the sulfur is released, and that's when you begin to smell the sulfur coming. Now, one of the things, back to my dad again, he said, now, you've got to have rutabagas in the spring of the year because it's a tonic. Now, there's some truth to that because there's sulfur in the rutabagas. However, our rutabagas were so loaded with sulfur that we couldn't get near them that particular year.
I think there are some milder versions out there now.
Well, there could be, but you don't want a milder version. I mean, if you want a tonic, you want the real thing.
Oh, man. Well, you know, rutabagas remind me of another plant that people have heard of but don't often try, and that's the kohlrabi. And you mentioned kohlrabi in your book, too.
Yes, kohlrabi is a fun plant to grow, and it's easy, and it's a little bit unusual. If I remember correctly, it's sort of a, people thought it was a cross between a cabbage and something else. But it's a good thing.
I like, how many people in the audience here like kohlrabi? Oh,
this is a kohlrabi group.
This is a kohlrabi group. There we go.
How many of you are German persuasion? Let me ask that.
More hands. Lots of,
yeah, that's a connection.
Oh
my goodness.
Oh, gosh. Well, the in your book, and in your book, you talk about the times you spend with your grandkids, and in a couple of minutes here.
Well, something on a serious note, in my mind, one of the very best ways to introduce children to an appreciation of nature and an appreciation for where their food originates is to have them work with you in the garden. There is no better way to learn about nature and the connection of people to nature than through gardening. And it's a chance to be out in the bright sunshine. It's a chance in our place to watch the bluebirds build a nest. Chance to watch the sandhill cranes fly over. Chance to watch the clouds go by. It's a chance to think. because hoeing is a mindless activity. And so you can think. And today kids are so, and I don't mean to sound critical, but wrapped up with their electronic devices, that the opportunity to be out in nature that is real, not some picture or some game, but it's real. And gardening is a wonderful, wonderful way of introducing children. One of my grandkids, a couple of them live in Colorado, and they were visiting, and I said, "Well, pull up this plant." He pulls this plant up. He says, "It's a carrot." I said, "Yes, it's a carrot." "Well, is that where carrots come from?" That happens a lot. Really, it does. Old guys like me, we take all this for granted. So if you want to do something really interesting, introduce your kids and your grandkids to gardening.
Jerry Apps, author of Garden Wisdom, Lessons Learned from 60 Years of Gardening. Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Boy, Garden Talks. Ben, we've been doing Garden Talk shows for a long, long time. And one guest I've had on many times on my show, but not on Garden Talk, is Jerry Apps. And that's why it's great to have him with us today for Garden Talk, because he has a new book out. It's called Garden Wisdom, Lessons Learned from 60 Years of Gardening. And we're broadcasting today, if you're just joining us, from the Fox Cities Book Festival on the UW Fox Valley campus. We've got a wonderful live audience. Hey, thank you. Big audience here today with us. So fun to have them along, and certainly great to have you listening in. If you have questions or comments or maybe some great stories to share about your own gardening, love to hear you at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. Or go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and you can post there. And I think we've already posted a few things relating to this event up on the Facebook page. So please go take a look at it. And we have, let's have a question from the audience.
I have first a comment and then a question. The comment is a story. I have this 50 years of marriage master gardener sitting next to me. And when we were first married, my father came over from his newspaper in Manitowoc for dinner. And my wife went down into the basement to make a rhubarb pie for him, a specialty. Well, she went down, baked the pie, and after dinner, my father started to eat it. And he said, "What kind of a pie is this?" She said, "Why?" He said, "It tastes like kohlrabi." And she picked up a package of kohlrabi and made a kohlrabi pie.
Out of the freezer. Oh, gotcha. But,
very healthy, very healthy.
But the more serious question, I am a tree farmer also. I manage an 87-acre wilderness plot up in northern Oconto County. And you were talking about trees. We have interspaced a lot of our land and put in maybe 50,000, 60,000 red pine over the years, hand-planted among all the old stumps from the logging. One of the things I'm questioning is this whole concept of monoculture, one species of pine versus multiple species with disease. What's your view on it?
Yeah, that can be a real problem. And one of the arguments I had with the DNR for years, they wanted me to plant my whole farm to pine. And I said, "I'm not going to do it." And they said, "Well, we can't work with you then." And I said, "Okay." Well, I think maybe the third forester that came along said, "I think we can work with you. We can not only don't plant everything to pine trees, but leave lots of open areas." And so I have open areas all over the place, and I mow them. By the way, one of the interesting things, maybe not that far north, but we are right in the middle of the Karner Blue Butterfly Range. And the Karner Blue, those of you that know that little butterfly, is a federally endangered butterfly. And they require lupins as an intermediary in order to reproduce. And we have 5 acres now of lupin, wild lupin. We've not planted any of it. And it is so fun to do these kinds of things along with my forestry work. And interspersed, to say what's similar to what you were talking about, in amongst part of my oak forest was logged 35, 40 years ago, and that, and we have interspersed that with the white pine and red pine and other species. But I'm blessed with my oak forest because I have in it birch, black oak, white oak, bur oak, a maple. It's sort of like humankind. You look around the room, you're not all the same. We're all different, and plant species, I think, enjoy the company of others.
I'm talking about maple trees this year.
Thanks for that comment and question. Abby in La Crosse has a question, I think, or comment. Abby, hi. Are you there? Well, maybe we lost Abby.
No, you tomorrow. Didn't. You just didn't push the button.
Oh, he didn't push the button. I don't have a button.
Okay, I'm here now. I need to talk about tomatoes. We have a house in the city and a garden in the backyard, just regular single-family house situation. And late in the season, we usually end up with problems with tobacco blight because we have neighbors on each side of us that are smokers. Now, I get along well with these neighbors, but I don't want to be the kind of neighbor that tells them that they can't smoke in their own yard. So my question is there something I can put along the fence lines to filter out the tobacco smoke as it's trying to blow into the yard? And I'll hang up and take my answer off the air. Thanks.
I wish I had an answer. I don't know what to suggest. I could suggest rutabagas, but they don't quite don't grow tall enough.
I don't know what you'd do with
it. I don't have an idea.
I mean, you probably even screen.
No,
screen
nothing.
Plantings, nothing.
No, nothing's going to do it.
No, I suppose they want to smoke outside because they're probably not allowed to smoke inside. That's one we can't. That's one, unfortunately, we can't answer. I'm sorry, Abby, but I don't have. Maybe somebody has an answer. You got an answer? Give us a call 1-800-642-1234, or maybe somebody in the audience has a question as well, or an answer as well. So we'll see what we can come up with. I'm thinking about the rest about your book, and we haven't talked. Did we talk about radishes yet? I don't think
we have. Well, we haven't talked about radishes. You want to talk about radishes?
Let's talk about radishes for a minute, because they're a member of the mustard family.
Yes. This year, for the first time in history, and this really a lie. It says 60 years of gardening. I said to my editor, it really should say 70. And she said, nobody's going to buy a book by an old codger who's been gardening for 70 years. So we backed it off 60. This year, for the first time in 70 years, I planted a major part of my garden in March, just for the sake of doing it. And what did I plant? I planted radishes and lettuce and beets and peas, and my radishes are already up about a quarter of an inch. And I so look forward to radishes because they allow me, usually in May, early June, that's the first vegetable that I'll go into the garden, and I don't tell my wife this, but I will pull up a nice big red radish, and I'll rub the dirt off on my pant leg, and I will bite into this radish, and it's like biting into spring.
Yeah.
It is wonderful. They're mild. As the season goes on, they get a little more tangy and bitey. But that first radish is just wonderful.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And the thing we're seeing now and what we're getting now are asparagus. I'm surprised to see.
Yeah, asparagus is coming up big time.
Are the audience seeing asparagus? Anybody raise? Yeah,
how
a few
about,
people clap if you got.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about rhubarb? Yeah. How about a rhubarb? Oh. And are there rhubarb pie fans in the group?
Oh, yeah. Nothing like rhubarb pie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, really.
And you've got a little piece on rhubarb.
I do, yeah.
And Ruth actually has three or four rhubarb recipes.
Yes, the book. Yes. Oh, we're big-time rhubarb people, right? Yeah, right up there with all the other stuff that we have talked about. Yeah.
Well, rhubarb, someone's trying to find the recipes, because there's rhubarb pie. I had an author on not long ago of a book about rhubarb, and I don't know if anybody here listening happened to have heard that that interview, but she uses rhubarb in many, many ways. That she uses it, for example, in dressing instead of celery. She chunks up rhubarb and uses it, and uses it in many ways that I hadn't thought of. I thought, man, I've got to try this. And then when I saw Ruth's recipes, I thought, well, here's some more for me to try.
I have found the recipes. Rhubarb cream pie, rhubarb cake, rhubarb crisp, rhubarb jello jam.
Rhubarb jello jam, yeah.
Yeah, we're rhubarbed big time here. Didn't realize I had so much rhubarb. More rhubarb than rutabaga recipes. Speak to my wife about that.
You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. Or if you have a question from the audience, we do have somebody up front who has a question. Oh, and somebody in the back as well. So let's take that question.
Kate from Appleton.
Mm-hmm.
About 5 years ago, I planted several grapes, and my husband built a trellis for them. So he invested labor there. And last year I discovered later in August that there were all kinds of little tiny black bugs on the other underside of the leaves. I called the nursery and they recommended spraying it with a combination of water and soap. And I did that, and in spite of that, both grapes died and I dug them out. My concern is I'd like to plant grapes in the same place so that my husband doesn't have to move the trellis. Do I have to treat the soil in any way so that those same insects don't come back again?
Do you remember what variety of grapes you had?
One was a Concord and the other was a white grape.
Yes. To tell you the truth, I don't know the answer to whether you should treat the soil. But I have a Concord grape vine that's now 20-some years old, and I've not had much of any problem with it at all.
I certainly wouldn't worry about planting it there in terms of insects.
No.
I mean, there's nothing you could put in the soil that would keep the insects
away. That's true.
Away. So, I'm not sure, did you, and you probably didn't identify what insect.
No, I didn't.
There's a nice extension publication, UW Extension publication on growing grapes in Wisconsin. And it's a good one, really good one. You can get it online at the Learning Store, learningstore.uwex.edu, I think it's what it is. Or just put in UW Extension Learning Store, and you can read it online, or you can just pick it up at the County Extension Office. And it's a great book, a great booklet.
We've had wonderfully good luck with our we have but one Concord grapevine. This we grow in Madison. And we grow it on a split rail fence right out front of our house. Way back when I decided to grow a vegetable garden in the front yard, which was a big no-no, and to sort of hide it, I put a split rail fence. To hide it even further, I put this grapevine on the fence. And it is a marvelous, marvelous thing. We get from a half to three-quarters of a bushel of grapes every year from that one vine. And Ruth, bless her, makes all kinds of grape jelly. And grape jelly is the Christmas present that you would get from us. If you stop to visit, you get a little jar of grape jelly. We've got some wonderful picture. On the back of the book is a picture of the grape jelly that those of you listening on the radio can surely see this picture.
If you go to my Facebook page, I think it's on the Facebook page. So I wouldn't worry about, you might want to, though, get the insect identified. If they come back this year, I would take a picture. If you could take a digital photo and send it to Phil Pelletieri at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at UW, or just take it into the your county extension office. They'll probably be able to identify it and tell you what you can use to treat it. But I, you know, it's sometimes you have problems with an insect like that for a year or two, and then maybe you don't have any trouble for several years.
I've discovered that as the years have gone by, the Concord grip's pretty tough. I really do almost nothing with it except in the spring of the year, I prune the life out of it. I prune it way back to it looks like I've killed it, and it just invigorates it beyond belief. It just takes off.
Yeah, and that's one of the things you'll find in the book, in
yes,
the extension.
Is how to do that. You
know. Is how to do that because it's a little bit of an art.
Yeah. Well, it's like cutting seed potatoes. You got to make sure there's an eye in each piece.
You know, one plant from the garden we haven't talked about yet is the strawberry.
Oh yeah, strawberries. Well, we grow strawberries mixed in our flower bed in Madison, and they really do well. People think we're nuts to do that. But I have this thing. My brother is a professional horticulturist, and he's a plant breeder, and he grows vegetables as well, but he grows a lot of flowers. And he and his twin brother, our favorite comment to him is, if you can't eat it, you shouldn't grow it. But that's sort of biased. But we do have a lot of flowers in our front yard. And in amongst the flowers, I have my strawberries. And they do pretty well.
And they do well in there.
They do well in there. They do. Of course, we had an acre of strawberries when I was a kid, so I had a fair amount of experience with strawberries.
We have a comment from the audience or question.
I've got a story about radishes.
Okay.
Years ago, we had lived in the country outside by Kakana, and we had a typical dairy farmer living right next door to us. And, of course, he knew the growing season, so on and so forth, and planting corn and so on. He loved radishes. So one year, he decided he was going to build a little mini hothouse. He had taken some old storm windows and just kind of built just a little lean-to. And it was behind behind his garage. So he couldn't see what was actually happening, but it was right next door to us, and I could see exactly what he was doing and so on. And so he had planted his radishes and put the window down, and so had the nice southern sun, coming in and was going to, he's going to raise his radishes and get the first crop of the year. Well, I went to the grocery store, and I bought a couple bunches of radishes with the leaves on, and proceeded to plant them interspersed with his rows. And I was watching out the window when he came out one morning and looked at those radishes. And I came out and I was talking with him and, being very, nonchalant and, innocent looking there. And he had the most quizzical look on his face. And I said, "Paul, what's wrong?" He says, These radishes, where did they come from? I just planted these seeds like 3-4 days ago. I mean, we had a hot sun, but
it's a new variety.
Looked at me, and the look was so precious. And of course, about that time, I started laughing. And then he looked at those radishes. "You bought those at the store, didn't you?" And then I had to admit it. Loved him anyway.
That's a great story.
That's a wonderful story. It reminds me, and this is totally off topic, but I'm going to say it anyway, a story that Click and Clack told about a guy who had, in this office who was bragging. He bought this new thing for his car that would extend the gas mileage. You get much better gas mileage. And so at work, they started, there was a lot of shaking heads here. The guys brought in a gallon of gas, and they were putting extra gas in his tank. And so he goes, the more he was bragging and bragging, well, it got up to the point where he was really getting, and then they got a hose, and they started siphoning. And so day after day.
Oh, Larry.
Oh, my goodness. It has nothing at all to do with gardening, but it's fun anyway. And Jerry, you've got some You're going to be roaming around the state here.
Yeah, I want to mention a few of these upcoming events, so to speak. At 2 o'clock this afternoon, for those of you interested in seeing some, hearing some more stories and seeing some pretty pictures, I will be at the Nina Library at 2 o'clock as part of the book festival. Then tomorrow at 12:30 to 2, I'm at Barnes & Noble in La Crosse. Next Saturday, the 21st, I'm at the Cedarburg Library at 1 o'clock. Sunday, the 21st of April, I'm in Fond du Lac speaking to the Historical Society at noon. And Sunday, April 29th, I'm at the Lucille Tack Arts Center in Spencer at 2 o'clock. I also write novels. Some of you may know that. And I will be talking about my four published novels at the Tack Center in Spencer on the 29th.
Nothing about the Garden Book.
Well, the Garden Book will be Nina, Barnes & Noble, Cedarburg.
Okay. All right. And you know, while I'm thinking of it, I wanted to take just a second here before we take another question. I want to take a second to thank a lot of people who have been here before we run. I want to make sure we mention this before we run out of time. Engineer Joe Hartke and Ellen Clark, where is Ellen, and Cynthia Schuster and Amanda Magnus, Scott Clark, Adam Friedrich, all these folks have done a whole lot of work to make sure that we have a lot of fun today and that we have a good show, and I really appreciate that. And so I wanted to make sure to mention that before our program is over. And so thanks to all of you guys. You do great work. We love you. Nick in Greenfield has a comment or question. Nick, are you there?
Can you hear me all right?
Yes, yes, I can.
Okay. We are on a city lot, and this is about my first and a year and a half into retirement, and so we've got a little 6x6 garden plot that we want to grow food, and not flowers. I agree with you. If you can't eat it, don't grow it. But last fall, I put down mulch of, grass clippings and leaves and so on. So now here it's the spring, and I'm looking at this mulch cover wondering, what do you do? I mean, do you plant through it? Do you rake it off? Do you grind it in? What do you do with it?
We got about a minute.
You bury it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the best thing to do. Shovel it under. Bury it. And it will decompose. And you will have added some wonderful organic material to your soil.
And then I would put some more organic material right on top.
Exactly.
And use it as a mulch so you don't have to do so much weeding.
Exactly.
And you're going to be really happy with your garden. I'm sure of it.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm sure we're about out of time, too. This is always a lot of fun, Jerry.
Yes, I need one more commercial. My website is jerryapps, jerryapps.com. Check it out. There's a schedule of where I'm speaking. Are all discussions
of my books. Daily kind of. Yeah, you have a kind of a daily.
No, only once a week. I write a blog, a weekly blog.
Weekly, right.
Weekly blog. It'd kill me if I had to do it every day.
Thanks for listening. Thanks for coming today. Really appreciate it. Larry Mueller here. More up next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.